everybody tries to do what the competition's not doing. So whatever business we're in, whatever service we provide, whatever products we offer, we try to do what the competition's not doing, so the customer picks us. In this four-year journey to get to the Olympic Games, I couldn't do what the competition's not doing because they already had a 20-year head start.
Welcome to Your Intended Message, the perfect place for leaders and promising professionals who want to convey the intended message for greater success. Every week, we interview experts who address the challenges and best practices to deliver your message effectively. That might be one-to-one, one-to-few, or one-to-many. And perhaps the most important conversation, one-to-self. I'm your host, George Torok.
My guest today is Vince Pacenti. Vince, there's three facts you should know about Vince. One, he is a celebrated expert in the world of communications. There are only four people on the planet who've been inducted into both the Canadian and the American Speakers Hall of Fame. Vince is one of them. His communication skills have a proven shelf life. He has maintained an in-demand schedule for speaking for 2.5 decades. And three, he is an expert in the world of impact and influence. As a New York Times best-selling author and Olympian, he is attuned to excellence, focus, and drawing people into stories they will never forget. Vince, welcome to Your Intended Message.
Hey, George, good to be with you again, virtually.
Great talking with you, Vince. And let's pick up on that last point, drawing people into stories they will never forget.
Right.
That's a powerful skill to have, and I guess it doesn't come naturally. There must be technique to it and practice. Tell us, how did that work for you? How does it work for you, and what can people take away?
Well, let's start where we end up, which is this is actually recently. I was at this cocktail party with this friend. No, I knew nobody at this event, and there was maybe about 40 people at this house party, and we're in a circle, and this guy starts telling a story. And I started to realize he was talking about me. And this guy had no idea he was talking about me. What's really interesting about this is as he got into relaying my Olympic story and all that, he revealed that it was some sort of pharmaceutical firm, Abbott Labs. And I went, Abbott Labs? And then I piped up and I said, that was 10 years ago. And he says, yeah, why? And I said, well, I was the guy. I was the guy standing on the chair. And he went, that's right, it was you. Now, the reason I share that end game to you is that if somebody can relate a story that they only heard for an hour of time, 10 years later, and in that span had seen hundreds of other speakers, well, then you're onto something, right?
And you know it's working.
You know it's working. And the tip of the spear with any kind of communication, and I'm not just talking about speaking, I'm talking about even emails, is to be able to have that impact and influence to get somebody's attention. And the only way to do that is through experience, when they experience the message. And so, as you said, it doesn't come naturally. There's a lot of technique to it, and we can dive into that through our conversation if you like.
Well, tell us some of those secrets there, Vince. What are the techniques? And I'm guessing the story I've seen you do is the one where you describe your experience as a downhill speed skier. Very few people in your audience are going to be Olympians. Almost none of them are going to be, probably none of them are speed skiers. And there's going to be a whole lot who aren't even skiers. So how do they experience your story?
Well, what I do now is draw them into what it feels like and smells like and all that. What I used to do is say, my opening was at the age of 26, I'd never ski raced before. And 4 years later, I was vying for the gold medal in the Olympic Games. And I'm here to share this story with you today. And so I talked about myself. I made the audience the observer of what I was saying. Now I open by standing on a chair on a sideways, you know, slope, like you're standing on the side of a 42 degree slope. You're going to go 0 to 60 miles an hour in 3 seconds. You're going to be up to 125 miles an hour in 8 seconds. All heck is going to break loose. You want to maintain a tight aerodynamic tuck. As you point those skis downhill, the skis are going all over the place. Do you see the difference? The first one was the audience is the observer of the story. And in the second one, I brought you into the story with language, you language. You're on the side of a 42 degree slope. Your body's pushing all around. I mean, the skis are going wap, 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 wap. I didn't say your skis. I said skis are going wap, 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 like that. So when you use language that draws them into the experience, get this, people never forget an experience. Like that guy 10 years later from Abbott Labs. I mean, it was just evident when you draw people into an experience, it sticks. And then once you give them an experience, you can Velcro content to that experience, which means they internalize that content rather than they have to source it and go back. And what did he say? And, you know, in the cerebral mode of trying to go through it, it's been internalized and then mission accomplished. That's, you know, that's being able to bring people into the content as well.
It's important, you said it's important for people to internalize the message. Now, how might a company leader, a corporate leader, a CEO, when they need to deliver a message, they don't have the excitement that you did of as an Olympic athlete. How can they get their employees, their staff to internalize the message, working on a project, working for a goal, building better customer service? How can that CEO do that?
Well, I've been coaching CEOs and VIPs and celebrities for the last maybe decade now, because there is a technique to it. And it really is, I'll give you the anatomy of communication, if you will. And it's the eyes, head, heart. Now, the sequence I would counsel any CEO to do is to get their attention, get their eyes, get their attention where they go, oh, this is different. So if the CEO stood up there and was reading off a teleprompter and said, what an honor to be with you here today. It's good to be with you. What I'd like to cover today is the kinds of things that we've been, you know, it's the antithesis of what you want to accomplish. What if a CEO started by saying, breakfast this morning was fascinating because the hotel had provided a buffet, but the waiter said, what if you actually went off the menu, and you know what I'd recommend? And he went down the list, and this waiter was taking down a path of the experience of breakfast. And all. What if you started that way? They're not expecting that. So that's the eyes, the head. Get inside their head with information that's innovative or counterintuitive. Either of those two things are essential to have people lean forward and go, oh, I hadn't thought of it that way. Thank goodness you're our CEO, right? So to have stuff to get inside their head, if you said stuff that's cliche or stuff that they're expecting or something that they already know, then your audience is gonna go, yeah, I know this. Yeah, I already got it. Check, check, check. Thanks, Einstein, you know? So if you say stuff that gets inside their head, make sure it's innovative or counterintuitive. Now, what if you were saying something that was conventional in nature, like we can't give up, we can never give up. As Winston Churchill said one time, we'd never give up, never give up. Well, yeah, okay, everybody's heard that one before, so that's not innovative or counterintuitive. But if that's the message you wanted to say, maybe you could say it this way. The first thing we have to do is give up. First thing we have to do is surrender. And people would say, what do you mean? Like, why are you saying that? Because giving up means that we've been able to step back and say, is this working? Is this approach working? And in order for us to be consistent and persistent and never give up is to be able to step back, look at it and go, oh, I get the picture. And then we move forward. I just said the exact same thing as never give up, but in an unconventional way, in a way that's innovative or counterintuitive, right? So, and then the heart piece is something personal, something vulnerable, something in a position where you're talking about teaching your kid to ride a bike for the first time, or the first time you rode a bike and you kept falling over, and something where there's vulnerability to it. When you connect with people's heart, then you got their attention, you got inside their head, and they've connected to you personally. And that sequence is magic.
Now that's interesting. When a CEO stands at the front of the room, probably the last thing that they are telling themselves that they want to do is to appear vulnerable or imperfect, because then people think they're not fit to be a leader. Yeah. But in reality, the truth is what?
The truth is, think of people in your life right now who you're most connected to. Think of people that you trust the most. Think of people that you would follow anywhere. And those people have shown their vulnerability. Think of people that you don't trust. Think of people that you wouldn't follow. Think of people that you kind of have your guard up. They have not shown their vulnerability. In fact, they've done the opposite of that. And there's this wall around them. That if that's the end game, if you want to connect with your people, if you want them to follow you, if you want to be able to have them feel that they are part of your life and you're part of theirs, then vulnerability is absolutely, and it's not about crying. It's not about, I love you, man. You know, it's about being real, authentic. I'm doing this on this call right now because, you know, at one point I was scratching my leg down here. Well, you know what? So that's not perfect, but whatever. It's this human experience. And there is a difference between acting authentic and being authentic, right? Or doing authentic. Yeah, that's an even better way to put it. There's a difference between doing authentic and being authentic. So being authentic is the winner.
How do we recognize the difference?
How do we recognize the difference?
Yeah.
Everybody has that, I call it the BS detector. And the BS detector kind of goes, and then you all of a sudden realize, yeah, I don't think this person is really doing what they're saying or whatever. There's a fair bit of intuition or internalization of the reading the person and that kind of thing. So,
and for the speaker themselves, the CEO speaker, the corporate leader, when they want to come across as authentic, how do they know that they're on track, that they are doing authentic, not just acting?
There is one way, which is like jumping off a cliff and learning how to fly on the way down. And that is to, I'll give you a case in point of the point being authentic on stage, or being authentic when you're communicating through a video like this. I spoke to a hotel, massive hotel chain. They had all their managers there. There was about almost 2,000 hotel managers all in the same room. And their theme that year is being spontaneous. They wanted everybody to be spontaneous and think on their feet. And if a guest needed something, that you provide that solution, no matter who you are, no matter who is working for you, it was spontaneity. That's their theme for the year. And the executives got up and were reading the teleprompter. This year is our year of spontaneity. We want to be able to think on our feet. They're reading the teleprompter. And I'm standing at the back going, am I the only one seeing this? And so, I don't know how much money and time and effort they put into that spontaneity. And the message cratered purely, not practically speaking. You could take a bucket of content and dump it on people's heads, but is it going to stick? Or you can provide something that's truly an experience. And that's why this coaching thing that I've been doing has been so valuable, is it's really the light bulbs coming on, and stop making everybody the observer of your message where they have to process and experience it. So to be able to communicate in that way would be to have bullet points. These are the 10 bullet points I want to hit, all right? And all the CEO would have to do is look at that bullet point. They know the content behind that. They know they may mess up. They may have to add something in a memo after that they forgot to mention or something. Okay, that's period. But if they went through these bullet points and went, so we have to talk about supply chain management. Supply chain management this year was not what it needed to be. Versus to supply chain management was not to the level of our expectation. What we wanted to be able to accomplish, you know, the difference is massive. And people, when you're communicating in a conversational tone, when you have, you own the stage from a confidence of the material, people lean forward. They want to know and experience what you have to communicate.
Now, does that mean now you're critiquing the use of the teleprompter? Does that mean that, and I appreciate that, but does that mean that they should memorize the presentation?
I'm not a fan of memorizing a presentation because then it's theater, you know? There are some triggers. Like the outline could have supply chain management, and then underneath it, it may have three subpoints that they really want to get across. And there's nothing wrong with looking down and going, oh, the supply chain management that's happening from Asia Pac, you know, is one of our biggest concerns because of the delay that's going on right now. And so, you know, I just said it in a conversational way. So the teleprompter, I've done this. I've actually had the teleprompter with the bullet points. And so the bullet points were there and I glanced at the bullet points and I knew what I was saying. So you could actually lay out bullet points on a teleprompter as well. The point is they want to know you. They want to feel like they're in a conversation with you and feel like they matter instead of an engineered kind of concept. And some CEOs just don't have those communication chops. I didn't. I mean, my first presentation, if I showed you a video, you would cringe, absolutely cringe by looking at it because it was so stilted, you know, and now it takes a while.
You mentioned that you coach executives and celebrities to deliver presentations. When they come to you, when they first come to you, what are the most common misconceptions that they have that you almost need to give them a slap to wake up and pay attention?
The first one is that the audience cares about you. Now, I'm being very facetious and cynical, but why not start there? Why not pretend that every single person in that audience doesn't care about you at all? All they care about is themselves, okay? So if you came at it from that standpoint, then you're no longer on stage to be the purveyor of knowledge and wisdom and direction. You're there.
They love me, yeah.
Engage them in a way to say, the supply chain management that's going on right now, we know this is frustrating. We know that's frustrating for each of us in this room. And for us to be able to engage in a way to be able to get past this obstacle is the only way we're going to be able to do that is to do it together. So let's figure out, you know, that language is so different than our supply chain management is something that needs to be fixed. And there are people in this room that know who that, or the version is, well, we would love to be able to have you work even harder this next year in Q2 and be able to have with this kind of outcome that we're aiming to have. And, you know, all these different angles of leadership and messaging and all that, man, when you come at it from a conversational tone and pretend that they only care about themselves, your language changes. We have three kids and they're now college age. When they were teenagers, holy moly, you learn a lot about communication, because guess who that teenager cares about? Themselves. Period.
Me.
It's me. It's me.
Center of the universe. Me.
Absolutely the center of the universe. So if you're going to communicate as a parent to a teenager, you definitely approach it from a different angle. And that kind of skill set comes into play when speaking to an audience as well.
Now, I'm curious, you mentioned your three children who once were teenagers and how you learned. Do you have, and you talked about being authentic and vulnerable. I wonder how vulnerable you can be right now. Do you have an embarrassing moment when you learned something about communication from your teenagers?
Well, it actually started when they were particularly young, and boys and girls communicate differently, by the way. So our boy is the oldest, and he was 4 years old. This is when I knew I had to get my game on. He had done something, and I yelled at him. I went, "Max, you can't do that." You know, I was really angry. And he was four, and he looked up with his blue eyes, and they were just blazing, and he just stared at me, and I went, "You know what? I'm sorry. I shouldn't have yelled. I'm sorry." He said, "That's not it." I said, "Well, yeah, it is it. I should not yell. I should say it in a very calm manner." He goes, "That's not it." I said, "Well, what is it, little buddy?" And he goes, "Well, don't you know you're teaching me how to be a father?" I was like, "Oh my gosh." So, yeah. And it was pretty much that way until about 22. It was constantly on my toes. Then later on, he says, "Don't give me that motivational speaker crap." So yeah, it's a lot of storytelling still with teenagers, and really moments where, you know, it to be told what to do. This, we're recording this during the pandemic, and down here in Dallas, God, you know, people just, some are just pushing back on the face masks thing. And I don't want to be told what to do. I'm in this freedom of rights is in the Constitution, whatever they're saying, you know, and people generally, by and large, don't like being told what to do. Teenagers included, employees included. And to be able to communicate in a way where we're in this together, and instead of telling them what the consequences are, let them figure it out. There's something called gestalt communication, where you say, "In my experience," or "This is what happened to me in the past," or "These are the kinds of things that I learned along the way." You give them the freedom and the choice to go, "Oh, I get what you're saying. Maybe that would work better if I did it a different way." So, and there's no rule book with teenagers, by the way. Good luck.
That would be a big bestseller.
Yeah. All the answers to raising a teenager. Yeah, it would be a very short book.
Yeah, everything I know about
the cover would be, I don't know, knock yourself out.
Everything I know about raising teenagers. Just one paragraph.
One paragraph.
They're annoying.
Yeah. Well, now they're college age, and because of the whole lock-in and stuff, my biggest problem was they're drinking all my beer. That's the problem. But they're going back off to college now, so get our house back.
Vince, you've been known as, you're most commonly known as a motivational speaker. Mm-hmm. You get people excited. You take them in your story. You use your experience as an Olympian. Right. You've also experienced. You've been part of 6 expeditions to the Himalayas, the Himalaya Mountains. That's where the big one is, Mount Everest. Exciting experiences that you have. As a motivational speaker, when a client says, "Vince, we want you to come in and speak to our team. It's the annual conference, the sales conference." What do you figure your key goal is when you're talking to this audience? What is it that you want them to get from you?
You could summarize it in 2 words, 2 concepts. One, to establish a goal that has an emotional buzz attached to it. So the audience member is so clear on where that end is, that where they need to head towards, you know. And the second way thing is how they show up. And it's through a methodology that I learned in sport. Because, you know, as I mentioned earlier, I started ski racing at 26, racing against guys who had been racing since they're 5. So everybody tries to do what the competition's not doing. So whatever business we're in, whatever service we provide, whatever products we offer, we try to do what the competition's not doing. So the customer picks us. In this 4-year journey to get to the Olympic Games, I couldn't do what the competition's not doing because they already had a 20-year head start. But you can do what the competition is not willing to do. And I'm telling you right now, that doesn't mean you have to work harder. It means working smarter. So the Olympic motto is Citius Altius Fortius, which means swifter, higher, stronger. Well, I added a fourth one called Smartius and competing smarter. When you show up and compete smarter, you end up having such a distinct advantage in any competitive landscape that you could even explain what you're doing and they would go, what? You know, I was at the library researching biofeedback and sensory deprivation float tanks, hypnosis programs. I mean, other athletes were going, I'm in the gym and I'm just doing reps. It's like, yeah, no. When you compete smarter, you end up superseding the competition. 26 years old, I was a recreational, never ski race before, didn't even know how to prep a ski, never been on a ski course, been recreational skier. 2 years later, 2 years after all this mental training and competing smarter, I was ranked 10th in the world in speed skiing, 10th. How does that happen? Is it because I'm lucky? Is it because, no, I was an architect for the mindset. And that all correlates to how you communicate, the mindset of being able to, if you're the architect for truth, you'll gravitate to that truth. And so called a motivational speaker, but I wish there was a category for motivating people to take innovative action that is specifically practical to what they do on a daily basis. That's what I do. You know, I don't think there's a word for that. Maybe the Japanese got one. I gotta ask.
Yes, they have a lot of words.
They have a lot of words that mean a lot of big things. Yeah. So anyways, is that racially insensitive? I don't know if I just, anyways, I'm sure.
No, they have some good somebody. Words that just don't translate. Yes. Yeah. Like Kaizen, you know, we don't have.
Perfect. Right.
Now, Vince, I'm curious about your journey as to become an Olympic athlete from recreational to 10th in the world in 4 years. I'm curious about the communication, the self-talk that you had to experience in order to get there, because I'm pretty sure it wasn't you sitting reading a manual or, and perhaps you had a coach and that's helped, but I imagine the big part was about Vince talking to Vince.
Yeah, that internal conversation is basically universal. There was a fella named Dr. Lee Poulos out of Vancouver, and I was sitting in a speech of his once, and he said, in a second of time, your conscious mind processes with 2,000 neurons. So in 1 second of time, your conscious mind is processing, you're listening to what I have to say, it might be making sense to you, you might be thinking about lunch you're going to have later, you might be thinking that I look like Steve Martin or Bill Clinton, or my wife says I look like the old man from Up. Whatever you're thinking consciously with 2,000 neurons is in that second. In the same second, the subconscious mind is processing with 4 billion neurons, with a B.
4 billion, wow.
4 billion subconscious neurons are firing off in your brain in a second of time versus 2,000 conscious. Now, who's in control? Obviously, the subconscious mind. But they call it subconscious for a reason. It's below consciousness. So obviously the subconscious is in control. The ratio that I then extrapolated from that and then turned it into a book is called The Ant and the Elephant. The ant is the conscious mind on the back of the elephant. The ant is making decisions on direction. We're going this way, says the ant. And it's on the back of the elephant going west. What if the elephant is headed east and is going, you know, this way? Which is the ant, way is the ant really going? East. Thinking he's going west. So the essential piece within that internal conversation you referred to is aligning your ant and elephant, aligning your conscious intention, that conversation or externally or internally that you're having, and that the subconscious mind wants to go in the same direction, where 2,000 neurons and 4 billion neurons are headed in the same direction. You have that kind of alignment, and then you're getting to the Olympic Games. You're creating a new product or service or reinventing yourself or pivoting a company. I mean, there's so many examples of companies that pivoted. There's companies that didn't. People that turned this kind of crisis into an opportunity. And this is This is has to do with an alignment of your ant and elephant, pointing those both of those guys in the same direction. Then it's then you just got to get out of the way. As a leader, if you've got your people with their ant and elephant headed in the same direction, just get out of their way, because this is going to manifest. I mean, you gravitate to that which you believe to be true, right? So what's true to your subconscious mind? So consistently what I would do is I would actually have a roll of them here. So you see these gold dots, this gold dot right here?
Mm-hmm.
There you go. Yep. Now, what I would do is put it on things like my cell phone. This one, my old gold dot just fell off. I noticed that. So then I put the gold dot on stuff. I've got it on my monitor here. I've got it over here. And every time I see a gold dot, back when I was racing, I'm the fastest speed skier in Canada, top 10 in the world. I'm the fastest speed skier in Canada, top 10 in the world. I never ski raced before. But if that gold dot comes true, you're marching in the opening ceremonies of the Olympic Games. That has an emotional buzz attached to it. That's like, oh, I'd love to do that. And when you have an emotional buzz from something, it means that your ant and elephant are headed in the same direction. It means this physiological reaction from just a thought means that this alignment of 2,000 neurons, of 4 billion neurons, are headed in the same direction. You are on to something. And as a CEO, if you're communicating a way that you get your people to have an emotional buzz attached to the vision of where you want to end up, goodness gracious. There's no accident that FedEx's order of priority is people, process, and profits. They start with the people. What do you need? Where do you want to go? Who do we serve? What do they need, right? And we're doing this together. Okay, FedEx was able to coalesce a bunch of people around the planet under this mission that we're in this together. And then the process, you know, we're going to live and die based on that. So they were very vehement about making sure that they delivered on that process. And they knew from people and process that profits would occur. There's an emotional buzz around that. 3M, innovate, right? If I work at 3M, I get to innovate. I love to innovate. That's why I was hired, right? So there's an emotional buzz there. What's your, you know, I'm talking to the CEO right now. What's your emotional buzz that everybody has about your company, where you're headed? Do you have one? If you don't have one, then start there. And if it's not working, then, you know, tweak it. Call somebody like George or myself. We'll come in and help you with that, right? So I don't know. We're in this together. So that's why I'm doing this call with you right now.
The emotional buzz. Now, is that something that may already exist but needs to be found, or does it need to be created?
I would say yes. I haven't been to one consulting session. It's not just keynotes that I do. It's not just coaching CEOs and VIPs. It's also these workshops that I've put people through. I worked with Boston Scientific. Here's a good example. And they knew what they were doing. They knew what they were on track to do. They just couldn't put it in a statement. Our coalescing statement, if you will, at that moment was, be the difference for life, right? It had a double entendre that they were being, not doing, be the difference, making the difference in the lives of others and themselves for life, for the lives of others and themselves forever, you know, for the long term. Be the difference for life. Once they got that statement, that gold dot of theirs, oh my gosh, they just lit it up. They were doing, this was years ago, the stents, those things that expand the stent. Anyway, so they were super excited about that, and then they just lit it up. Am I the reason for that? I don't know, but yeah, they were certainly on board.
I remember, if I remember my science, the stent is what they put inside a vein or an artery to
expand or to keep it open.
I like a big difference between the word being the difference in life as opposed to doing.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. Are you a human being or a human doing? Right? I know there's engineers listening in going right now, I'm a doer. Where's the data? Yeah, no, it's really both. I love that symbol, that the Chinese symbol of the yin and yang, right? Two things that being and doing, they interact, they become part of the whole. And the yin and yang of the emotional buzz is it's also important that this gives you anxiety, that this scares you. This makes you afraid. This gold dot of yours, for this reason. And I pulled this from an author named Stephen Pressfield, who's become a friend over the years, and his book called The War of Art. So buy that book, The War of Art, because in there he exposes that if you're afraid of something, it's important to you. So that means you need to go towards that because it's important to you. If you weren't afraid of it or you're indifferent to it, then it's not important to you and it wouldn't cause fear anyway. So this fear and emotional buzz attached, that yin and yang of those two things, it scared the hell out of me to think that I was going to go to the Olympic Games as a recreational skier. I'm not superhuman. I don't have this gene that just goes, oh, whatever, I'll just do it. I'm actually pretty analytical. This is nuts. 2 years into this, just before this top 10 ranking, I mean, I wasn't even on my first year of the World Cup circuit. I mean, I was just going, am I an idiot? Like, what am I doing? There was no evidence because you just don't go to the national team and say, hey, I'd like a turn. You don't go to the Dallas Cowboys and say, I'm a heck of a kicker, you know? So, no, you know, you got to earn your way in there or find a way to get exposed to the right people, all that kind of stuff. Yeah, it'll scare you. Yes, it'll be difficult. But, man, if it has that emotional buzz that's combined with that anxiety, that's exactly where the direction you need to be going. And it's exactly what CEOs need to communicate to their people. That they draw out of those people what that emotional buzz, what that gold dot is for them, that they put it on their cell phone and they look, okay, this is what I need to accomplish. This is where I'm headed.
Powerful tips. Vince, you are available for coaching and consulting with executives and celebrities to help them improve, well, actually take their presentation from good to great. They, yeah. People who are interested in that, they can find your website, VIP, as in very important person, Dias, and that's Dais.com. Yep. Do I have that right?
You do? Yeah. VIP Dias. I only take 2 clients per month. I don't take people that need Toastmasters because that's what Toastmasters is for. Do that. But it's really for people that are good on stage, that are giving a message, CEOs who are giving a message. They've been doing it a lot. But there's a way to be great. If you don't engage with me, just figure out how you're going to be able to draw people into an experience.
Now, that might be an appropriate comment to end on. For those CEOs out there, not every one of them is going to hire you or me. But if there's one change they could make in the next presentation that they deliver to take advantage of the buzz, what would that piece of advice be?
The advice would be a sequence of how you communicate a point that you're trying to get across. And it's a sequence of point, story, connect, point. Make a point that's innovative or counterintuitive. Tell a story that brings them into the experience. Then connect it to them on how it makes sense in their world. It could be a case study, something another company did. Just connect it to them. And then reiterate that point that's innovative or counterintuitive. And if you go through that 4-part point, story, connect, point, and you just repeat that, they'll jump to their feet at the end. They will be so excited to be part of the journey you're taking them on.
Make those changes to your next presentation and you will be fabulous. You'll be outstanding, a star in your own organization. Yeah. My guest today is Vince Pocente, the one who's helping you find and connect with their buzz.
If you like what you heard, remember to like, comment, and share this podcast. Come back every week for more practical insights to help you deliver your intended message. I'm your host, George Torok.